Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour at Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Law, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Joshua's Long Day when we come back. You know, once in a while we get a glimpse of the real world through the eyes of an insider. An insider like John Swinton, for instance. He said, there's no such thing at this date of the world's history in America as an independent press. You know it, and I know it. Swinton was the guest of honor at a banquet which was given to him by the leaders of his craft. And someone who knew neither the press nor Swinton offered a toast to the independent press. And that's what Swinton said when he outraged all of his colleagues. He went on to say that there's not one of you who dares to write your honest opinions, and if you did, you know beforehand that it would never appear in print. And I'm paid weekly for keeping my honest opinions out of the paper that I'm connected with, and others of you are paid similar salaries for similar things, and any of you who would be so foolish as to write your honest opinions would be out on the streets looking for another job. And if I allowed my honest opinions to appear in one issue of my paper, before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone. The business of the journalist is to destroy the truth, to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, and to sell his country and his race for his daily bread. Now you know it and I know it. And what folly is this toasting of an independent press? We are the tools and vassals of rich men behind the scenes. We are the jumping jacks. They pull the strings and we dance. Our talents, our possibilities, and our lives are all the property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes. Unquote. Well, these rich men that Swinton was talking about behind the scenes are the movers and shakers of this Global 2000 program and the New World Order. They're the men and families like the Windsors and Rockefellers and Bushes and Bundys and Carnegies and Vanderbilts. That's why I contend that it's time that you and I wise up and start listening more to the God of Abraham and stop following after all these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians, and let's prepare to live through and survive this New World Order and Global 2000 insanity. Now, if you'd like to learn more about Global 2000, Bible prophecy, and this New World Order, why don't you call and order my free 4-hour compact disc package? Now, it's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative. Best of all, it's free, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and then send an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. In the pages of the Bible, there's a story in Joshua chapter 10 that describes an event in world history. It's the day that the world stood still. You've probably heard that term. There was a movie made, a science fiction flick of that name, The Day the World Stood Still. This is not a science fiction flick. This is a true, accurate, and correct historical event described in the Bible. It's one of those miraculous events, probably more spectacular than Jesus walking on water. Heck, it might even be more spectacular than Elijah raising that small boy from the dead. I don't know if it's easier to stop the world for 24 hours or if it's easier to raise somebody who has died back to life. I can't do either one, so I can't tell you which is the more difficult. But the critics have had a field day laughing and hooting and jeering about this biblical story containing just 271 words. 271 words describe the whole thing. God doesn't spend a lot of time on superfluous hyperbole. He can codify as much in 4 words as the United States Code can in 4 or 5 volumes, such as Thou Shalt Not Steal, which is codified in Title 18 of the U.S. Code. So, in this narrative story, it's a little story here about the day that the world stood still for about 24 hours. And there are 4 major objections that critics have come up with. The critics say that Joshua didn't write this story, that it's a myth, and that it was written by some unknown scribe more than 1,000 years later. And then there are others that say it's just a plain myth. You know, it's kind of like Noah's flood and the creation in 6 days. it doesn't have anything to do with truth or accuracy. It's just a story. And the third thing they bring up is that the Earth can't stop, that it's physically impossible for the world to stop. And if the world did stop, it would violate some unknown law of physics. I don't know what the law of physics is that it would be violating, but that's what we're told by higher criticism. And then the fourth thing is that if, in fact, such an event had occurred, surely there would be evidence of something like that. I don't know what kind of evidence. They didn't say with specificity that they were looking for walls knocked down like Jericho, or that they were looking for a Grand Canyon, which is prima facie evidence of a worldwide flood, or they were looking for astronomical evidence, or that they were looking for a written historical documentation or something. I don't know what it is they're looking for, but they complain that there's no evidence of the event. Those are the four complaints, four criticisms of this story. Frankly, I don't know. I wasn't there, so I can't testify to the veracity of the 271 words written in Scripture. Furthermore, I haven't talked to any of these higher critics or heard any of them say that they were there and that they want to put in their testimony into the record and dispute this record that is written in the Bible. So they weren't there and I wasn't there. I think that the account's pretty true, accurate, and correct. I think that it's exactly on point. I don't have any reason not to believe it. I wasn't at the Battle of Gettysburg, but I believe that Gettysburg and the Battle of Gettysburg occurred in Pennsylvania rather than Sacramento, California. Now, the reason that I believe the Battle of Gettysburg occurred in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, is because that's what I've read in the historical accounts, which is a matter of law, come under what we call the ancient documents rule. And if I wanted to dispute the Battle of Gettysburg in a courtroom, the burden would be on me to go forward and prove that the battle did not occur in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Furthermore, I could say, and if such a battle did occur, then there would be historical evidence of that battle. Well, is there any historical evidence of that battle occurring in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania? And before you jump up and say, well, of course there is, have you ever been to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania? And all of you who said, no, I've never been to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, can sit down and shut up, because as a matter of law, all you have to offer is hearsay. You can only testify as to what you've read, what somebody told you. You didn't see anything. I was there. I physically saw the battlefield. And as a matter of fact, except for all of the plaques and everything that the monuments and et cetera that's around there, I couldn't see any evidence of Pickett's charge. I saw a place in a field where there was a monument there, and it said, this is where Pickett's charge began, and they went up this slope, and there's where the Union forces were located. But boys and girls, honest to God, all I have is hearsay testimony from people who wrote those monuments that got hearsay testimony from others that got hearsay testimony from others who got hearsay testimony, which presumably came from somebody that was an eyewitness and who was there. So, you know, when these higher critics take a look in the Bible and they say, well, I don't believe that. So what? You mean to tell me that the Battle of Gettysburg didn't occur because I say I don't believe it? Does truth depend upon what somebody believes or doesn't believe? What the hell difference does it make, whether you believe it or don't believe it? Now, insofar as Joshua's long day is concerned, I can prove that the critics who say that Joshua didn't write it are liars. Liars. And those that say that Joshua didn't write it know better. See, if they were ignorant, then it would be a mistake of fact. But there is proof that Joshua wrote it. Or if Joshua didn't write it, whoever did write it was an eyewitness to the transaction. Eyewitness. And furthermore, I'm going to show you that the guy that is the eyewitness to the transaction is none less than God himself. Second thing, the story is pure myth. No, the story isn't pure myth. It's a historical fact written in five languages in five different historical accounts. That isn't a myth. That's a fact. And there's four ways that we can prove that this is a historical event that transpired. Now, somebody else comes along and he says, the earth can't stop. Why can't it? I don't know why the earth can't stop. Do you? And somebody said to me, if the earth, which is spinning at 1,000 miles an hour, were to stop, then all of the people and all of the things that are on the earth would continue spinning at 1,000 miles an hour, and it would just destroy everything on the planet. And I thought about that for a minute, and I said, my God, anybody that would make that kind of a dumbass statement would have to have letters after his name. Excuse me. But I'm an old-timey pilot, and I can tell you from personal experience that I was riding one time in a Boeing 747. Now, I don't know how fast that sucker was going, but the pilot came over the intercom and said that he was cruising at 535 miles an hour. Now, I don't know if that guy's lying or not. Hell, he might have been going 375 and then lied to us and said he was going 525. I don't know. I wasn't in the cockpit. I couldn't see the airspeed indicator, but from my vantage point sitting out there in the audience, I didn't have any reason to disbelieve him, and I've read many accounts that say that those airplanes do in fact travel at about 550 miles an hour or thereabouts. All right. Well, I can testify, boys and girls, that the airplane was dead stopped in Chicago. Dead stopped. It was not moving. I felt the power being applied to the airplane, and I could look out the window and see that the airplane started to move forward down the runway. The airplane continued to accelerate, and pretty soon the airplane left the ground and started flying through the air. Somewhere between Chicago and Honolulu, the pilot said, "We're traveling at 525 miles an hour." Then the airplane came down out of the sky at Honolulu and landed on a runway there at the Honolulu airport. And the airplane decelerated to a complete stop at the terminal. I can testify as an eyewitness, I was there, that the airplane started from a dead stop and completed its travel at a dead stop, and in between it traveled at 525 miles an hour. And boys and girls, my cocktail never left the tray, not once. And everybody arrived alive. And I can testify that you can accelerate from 0 to 525. Now, I never traveled at 1,000 miles an hour. That's a little faster. But I have read accounts where airplanes can travel up to 2,000 miles an hour. They can accelerate from 0 to 2,000 and decelerate from 2,000 to 0. Now, of course, the question is, well, how long does it take to accelerate and decelerate? Well, now, my flight was 13 hours in duration. So I know that we can go from 0 to 525 and back to 0 in 13 hours. Do you think maybe we could shorten the time up a little bit? Well, they got airplanes that land on aircraft carriers and they decelerate pretty rapidly. They can take off from 0, accelerate up to 1,000 miles an hour, and then they can circle around behind the aircraft carrier and slow down and land, and they can do that circuit in 15 minutes. So I know from what I have observed and read from the photographs and the videotapes that airplanes can take off of an aircraft carrier, circle the carrier and come back and land, accelerating from 0 to 1,000 and back to 0 in 15 minutes. Gee, do you suppose if we put our minds to it that maybe we could decelerate from 1,000 miles an hour to 0? How much time does that take? Well, could it be done in 60 seconds? I think that might be a little bit unreasonable. How about 2 minutes? That'd be 120 seconds. 3 minutes? 4 minutes? 5 minutes? And, you know, you're riding in this F-14 or F-16 or whatever this airplane is, and this guy's got the afterburners on, and, I mean, he just socking it to her. He's got the pedal to the metal. And we're looking down here at the airspeed indicator, and there it is at 1,000 miles an hour. He's going faster than the speed of sound. All right. He pulls the power. The airplane is going to start to decelerate. How long does it take an airplane to decelerate from 1,000 down to about 130 miles an hour, which is about landing speed? I don't know, but I can tell you from personal experience that a Cherokee 6 traveling at 160 miles an hour, when you pull the power, you can slow her down to about 70 miles an hour, which is about landing speed, in less than a minute. So I know I can go from 160 to 60 or 70 in less than 60 seconds. And my gut reaction would say to me, I think that we could slow a 1,000-mile-an-hour airplane down to about landing speed in about 2 or 3 minutes, I think. I could be wrong. Now, if you got some pilot out there, why don't you write me an email and tell me how long does that deceleration take? Now, at 130 miles an hour, all we got to do is approach the fantail of the ship and land the airplane. And they got a cable on there that's going to slow us down from 130 to zero. And boy, that doesn't take long. I bet it doesn't take 5 seconds. You ever watch those airplanes land on those aircraft carriers? Man, when that guy hits that cable, he better have his lunch securely positioned because it's liable to be coming out his nose. Now, when somebody says that you can't stop planet Earth because everything's going to fly off of it and everybody's going to get killed, my own personal experience says that that's just balderdash. And the 271 words don't tell us how long it took God to slow the earth down from 1,000 to zero. Whether it was 1 minute, 2 minutes, 5 minutes, or 10 minutes, the account doesn't say. And I wasn't there, and I don't know, and I don't know of anybody else that can testify in the first person as an eyewitness who can say that it did or didn't happen that way. But I can certainly testify from my own experience, it's certainly possible. All right. Furthermore, it just occurred to me that a guy that can create the earth, the moon, the heavens, and all that therein is in 6 days, it would seem like to me he could stop the planet for 24 hours. It would seem like to me that a guy that could build Grand Coulee Dam could probably install an electric turbine in it.
Doesn't seem like to me that the installation of the turbine is a greater feat than building the dam. It doesn't strike me that stopping the earth for 24 hours is a greater feat than building the thing to start with, does it? Then the last item over here, that there would be evidence of the event, is testified to by a number of historical sources that tell us, oh yeah, it did occur. And it's identifiable astronomically by the eclipses and by the movements of the planets and the sun and the moon and the earth. And that's called astronomy. And it's been done by more than one astronomer. And the documentation is available. And the guy that I'm going to give you the information from is called C.A.L. Totten, M.A. He was an astronomer up at, he was in Connecticut. Now, I don't know if it was Princeton or Harvard. Harvard's over in Boston, but he was in Connecticut. Maybe it'll tell us what the school was that he was working at. So we have four lines of proof here, four lines of evidence that we can appeal to, not the least of which is that the scripture tells us plainly that it's written by a guy named God. We call him God. I don't know his name. He's never introduced himself to me, but a lot of people out there, you know, they call him Yahweh or Yah, or they call him God or Baal or Buddha or Allah, and they got all these names for him over here. I don't know what his handle is, but here in the Western world, we just call him God, G-O-D. Probably isn't his name, but it's the guy that created the heavens and the earth. It's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you know, so that we can kind of identify this particular God. There's a lot of them out there. I'll confess there's a bunch of these gods. This is a particular God, and he says, well, now let me tell you my story in the first person. And he says, I'm the God that cannot lie. I'm the same yesterday, today, and forever. And all scripture is given by inspiration of God, and it's profitable for doctrine, reproof, correction, and instruction. So I just thought I'd share that with you. This guy says, well, let me tell you my story, and here's the way it works. One of the most difficult tasks that faces an instructor is that of correcting a false impression which has become deeply rooted in a student's mind. And it is a lamentable fact that the present generation of college students has been so indoctrinated with this false idea of evolutionary philosophy that modern science and the Word of God are at hopeless variance. And therefore, it's a constant struggle to make the truth known to these people. Some of the most childish ideas are offered as evidence and accepted by a credulous population or a credulous world without any investigation. Some of the most ignorant errors are joined with some of the most fallacious scientific fables, all of which are then presented as unquestionable proof and are then received as proof. So the purpose of this mass of misinformation is to demonstrate that modern science has proved that the Bible is a book of folklore and myth. Now that's the purpose behind it. And that's why I said these skeptics over here are liars. They know better. Or they should know better. In law, we say he knew or he should have known. So by the time you get a PhD after your name, partner, you know, or you should know, or you should shut up, one of the three. Now, we've always been ready and eager to answer all questions at any time as far as our knowledge will permit. Being just a poor, crummy plumber over here, I don't know everything. But the little bit that I do know, I can espouse with confidence. Now, in student conferences, we often meet the same questions over and over again, but there is no question that we have met more often than any other. This query concerning the long day of Joshua, this is perhaps the last and the most frequently used argument, which is directed against the authority, the credibility, and the scientific accuracy of the Bible. And I'm going to underline that last phrase, the scientific accuracy of the Bible. The other day, I had a preacher here in class, and I don't have those very often. Hell of a nice guy, very friendly, good-looking fella. And he's a preacher, and we got to talking a little about the Bible, and I was absolutely amazed about the biblical ignorance that this preacher displayed. I mean, this guy couldn't find scriptures in the Bible that are so common that, you know, you'd think that a fifth or sixth grader could be able to recite those. When I was a kid, they used to make us recite scriptures in the Bible. This guy didn't have a clue as to where these were. Well, anyway, as we were talking along, he said that he did not believe that the Bible was the infallible, inspired word of God, that it was filled with all kinds of scientific errors. Now, remember, this guy's been to college. He's got letters after his name. And he said that he thought, he believed, that the Bible was filled with scientific errors. And I said, well, could you cite some of these scientific errors? And he said, well, you know, the creation account in Genesis 1, that's a scientific error. And I said, well, I didn't know that. I what was it about the Genesis account there that's unscientific? And he said, well, you know, we know now that the world has evolved over billions of years. And, you know, the Bible says that it was created in 6 days. Obviously, that's a scientific error. I said, I didn't know that the world had evolved over billions of years. I thought, if I understood this topic correctly, that that was a theory, a hypothesis, that it was philosophy. And he assured me, he assured me that it is a documented scientific fact that the world evolved over eons of time. Now, boys and girls, I'm just a crummy plumber. But listen, you went to high school, didn't you? Do you remember in high school science class, do you remember they told you about the first and second laws of thermodynamics? This was in Science 101 in the ninth grade. Do you remember that? When Mr. Turner stood up and he said that there has been no past eternity of matter, that matter has not always existed, and that matter is slowly decaying into energy, that mass and matter are energy that is manifested in a physical form, it is degenerating and will ultimately reduce itself to a low-level mass of energy throughout the universe. Now, do you remember that? Yeah, just think back now for a second. Okay, that's number one. Now, if you take a look here at the evolutionary Big Bang concept, you remember that all of this mass and matter was compressed into a very small container, and that it exploded, and that what you're looking at today is the results of that explosion. Now, let's ask this question. Where did that mass and matter that was compressed into that very small container come from? And the answer is, it has always existed. But do you remember Mr. Turner in the ninth grade said, mass and matter, first law of thermodynamics, has not always existed, that it came into existence at some point in time. We don't know when, we don't know how, we just know that it has not always existed. There's a law involved here. All right, now somebody's lying to you. Either Turner lied to us in high school physics class when he said that mass and matter have not always existed and the first and second laws of thermodynamics are a lie, or mass and matter did not explode in the Big Bang, one or the other. Now, boys and girls, I'm just a plumber, but I'm not brain dead. Now, just think about what these people are telling you. Somebody's lying. Now, he might be telling you a story because he doesn't know the answer. In the Bible, there's a guy comes up front and center, and he says, gather around, little grasshoppers, and let me tell you where the mass and matter came from. I made it. He even goes on to tell you how long it took him to make it. These scientists over here say, well, gosh, we don't know, but here's what we think. Now, if you walked into court and you got on the witness stand and said, I don't know, but here's what we think, you would be objected to and dismissed. And if you persisted, you'd get Rule 11 sanctions applied to you on top of it. That kind of crap isn't admissible in court. Now, why it's admissible in college classrooms is beyond me. I thought college was a place where we went to get knowledge. It isn't. It's a place where we go to listen to fairy tales. And evolution is the chief of those fairy tales. Now, you may sit here and say, stopping the world, which is spinning at 1,000 miles an hour, is really a hard thing to do. I don't doubt it. I can't do it. But then, hell, I can't build Grand Coulee Dam either. But I don't doubt that somebody else could do it. I never raised anybody from the dead. There's five examples in the Bible of people being raised from the dead. I wasn't there. The eyewitness accounts verify it. I wasn't at Gettysburg, but I don't doubt Gettysburg or Grand Coulee Dam or the resurrection of those five people just because I wasn't there. You know, boys and girls, there's a lot of things that go on in the world that none of us have ever viewed. We didn't see it, taste it, touch it, smell it, or feel it. But that doesn't mean that it isn't true or that it didn't happen, does it? Hang on a minute. Let me give you a mid-course correction here. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law, eight scriptures, or eight schools altogether. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by pre-arrangement, and the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. Now, if you'd like more information, you can go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Now, The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. And The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call The Law School and ask for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. 67. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily 100% endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or of this local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about Joshua's Long Day. Now, I'm citing a section out of Harry Rimmer's book, which is called The Harmony of Science and Scripture. Harmony of Science and Scripture, the author's name, Harry Rimmer. We'll also take a look at Dr. C.A.L. Totten, who's an astronomer, and we'll take a look at Joshua's Long Day and the Dial of Ahaz and document for you this strange phenomenon called Joshua's Long Day. Now, the record of the long day of Joshua has given rise to more argument and debate on this subject of inspiration of the Bible than has any other single factor of the problem. Yet, when Joshua's record is properly studied and all of the evidence is weighed and considered, there isn't any chapter in the entire Bible that is more valuable in establishing the truth and the infallible character of the Scriptures than this story in Joshua chapter 10, Joshua's Long Day. Many questions about this miracle occur, no doubt because of the paucity of the details in Joshua's account of this battle at Beth Horon. This ancient battle was one of the greatest battles that is recorded in the annals of history, much more significant than any battles of World War I or World War II or Waterloo. The significance of this fact is totally overlooked, but there was no single battle in the recent World War, World War I, that could compare with this one in its far-reaching significance and historical results. And to some extent, every nation, every land, every country under the sun has been affected by Joshua's victory at Beth Horon. In this battle, Joshua crushed a powerful league which opposed the people of Jehovah in their entrance into the Promised Land where the Messiah must be born. As a result of Joshua's victory, the way was opened for Bible prophecies to be fulfilled in the most literal fashion. The crushing victory of Joshua at Beth Horon was the means by which the fulfillment of God's covenant with Abraham and gave this land of Canaan to Israel. From this time on, the various battles of the Israelites could be referred to as a mopping up operation, for this was the end of organized opposition. Now, the most powerful alliance of which the enemy were capable opposed Joshua on the plains of Beth Horon. When the five kings died there and the army of the allies was destroyed, the entire land was open to the possession of the children of Israel. As a result of that battle, nations were exterminated. The citizenry, the government, the culture, the destiny of a great land were changed in that hour of victory forever. Through the Hebrew conquest of the land of Canaan, even the destiny of the United States of America, France, Germany, Great Britain, then undreamed of, was definitely shaped. For as a result of this battle, Jesus was born in accordance with the prophecies in the land that then and there changed ownership. Title to the land was seized. Now, this battle may be likened in its far-reaching effects to the Battle of Waterloo. And yet the entire account of Joshua's victory from the setting forth of the army on their forced march from Gilgal until their return to Gilgal is given in just 271 words. 271 words of history for the most important, the most momentous, and the most far-reaching military engagement in the history of the world, which most people have never even heard of. There have been more books written about the Battle of Waterloo than the 271 words that are contained in this entire historical account. So the details in this account are necessarily meager. Every word in this record, like a constitution of a nation, must be studied carefully. And the casual and careless reader will certainly think this account is highly improbable without even realizing that it is his own ignorance which makes it seem so. Now, the setting of this battle is of tremendous importance. So let's take a moment and take a look at the historical significance of the setting of the battle itself. And the reader will recall that the book of Joshua contains the record of the conquest of the land of Canaan by the army of Israel. It would be of value at the outset of this study to refresh the memory of a summary of the account of this conquest as given in the book of Joshua. Chapters 1 through chapter 5 deal with the entrance of the people into the land, their preparation for the great conquest, and the consecration of the nation to this task. The story of the conquest really begins in chapter 6, which deals with the capture of Jericho. The strange incidents in connection with that event have long been a source of delight to skeptics and agnostics and doubters, who has imagined that the falling of the walls of Jericho constitutes a quaint fable, and it really has no historical value. The light of the lamp of archaeology, however, has illuminated the events that transpired at Jericho and has established the record of the sixth chapter as being historically unquestionable. The great Marsden expedition under the leadership of Dr. Garstang has not only established the historical accuracy of the sixth chapter of Joshua, but has brought to light details of the conquest that prove that the book of Joshua had been written by an eyewitness of the fall of Jericho. The ablest archaeologists of the 20th century have proved beyond question that the events of chapter 6 happened exactly as they were written by the pen of Joshua. So the critics can now sit down, shut up, and fold their hands. Now the seventh chapter deals with the defeat of Israel at Ai. The sin of Achan was then discovered and purged, and as a result, in the eighth chapter, the record is given of the capture of Ai and the extermination of its population of some 12,000 people, and that included all of the men, women, and children, along with all of their dogs, cats, pigs, cows, sheep, and goats. Everything was put to the sword and destroyed. This recapitulation brings us to the stirring events of the ninth and tenth chapters of the book of Joshua. In the path of Joshua's march of conquest, there were six great and powerful nations. These nations are all named in the Bible. They were the Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, Jebusites, Perizzites, and the Hivites. One of the most important for the purposes of the narrative is the nation called the Hivites. Their capital city was at Gibeon, and it numbered about 30,000 people, a city about the size of Eureka, California. This city of Gibeon was next in Joshua's line of march and was a walled city, and it was well defended and skillfully protected. Now, among the reigning monarchs of these six nations was a crafty and able statesman whose name was Adonai Zedek, a man famed in his day not only for his political craft but for his military genius. He had been observing with deep concern the advance of the Israelites, and as he saw their invincible progress, he realized that no single nation in Canaan would be able to stand before them. So he called together the other five reigning kings, and he proposed a League of Nations. This League of Nations was to be composed of the six remaining nations of Palestine, of which the League, Adonai Zedek, was to be the leader, or the head. Now the nations of Palestine eagerly accepted this proposal, and the League of Defense was formed. Now, may we pause here to remind you that these ancients were real people, and it's sometimes hard to understand that the people and the nations that occur as names in these old records, such as the Bible, these old ancient documents, were actual folks of flesh and blood, just like you and I are today. And they had the same ambitions and passions and pleasures and sorrows that stir our feelings today. They lived and they died. They laughed and they wept. They worked and they played. And they had the same problems to face, like how am I going to make a living and how am I going to make enough money to pay the rent, just like you and I do today. Now, the Hivites, stirred with concern behind their massive walls, were as excited by the thought of this coming siege and battle as you would be today if your city were surrounded by a Russian or a Chinese army. If an alien army suddenly appeared on the horizon, threatening to loot and destroy your habitations, I submit to you, you would be very, very concerned. Now, the history and the records of the Hivite people appear in the findings of archaeology, where they are known as the Hovite nation, spelled H-O-V-I-T-E. Adonai Zedek, the head of the ancient League of Nations, was informed of the overthrow of the city of Jericho and was possessed of the details of the capture of Ai. He knew that he faced a tremendous military power. His strategy called for the sacrifice of the Hivites. He desired to use the city of Gibeon as a buffer between the Israelites and the rest of the League of Nations, while the army of the League took time to prepare for the defense of the rest of their territory. Now, we've often thought that this record should be a comfort to those courageous men who have kept our nation out of the League of Nations, There's nothing new in this idea of a League of Nations or a United Nations, for here is one that dates back 35 centuries. This League of Nations was organized to frustrate the people and the plan of God. It was headed by a man of worldly wisdom who knew nothing of God and knew nothing of God's plan for the land wherein he dwelt. This land was foul with the most unnatural sins and wickedness, just like our land is today, and the only way that the land could be purged was by the removal, the forced removal of the source of this infection, which was the entire, totally degenerated population. Now, the League recognized no law save the law of expediency, and when its leader thought that it was desirable, he didn't hesitate to sacrifice one entire nation. Don't think it a thing strange. That's precisely what the Russians, the British, and the Americans did in World War II, when they sacrificed Poland and the Sudetenland and Austria to Hitler in the late 1930s. Now, you may be sure that the nation that was elected to the sacrifice was not their own people. You didn't see the Americans or the Russians volunteering to be the sacrifice before Hitler. No, no, they sacrificed the Poles. They sacrificed the Czechs. Well, Adonai Zedek's strategy called for the fortification of this capital city, his capital city, Jerusalem. And in that region, he intended to mass the combined army of the League in the hope that he could crush Joshua and the Israelites in a pitched battle there. So he called a secret meeting of this League of Nations, but he failed to inform the Hivites that the meeting was being held. And, no doubt, with very skillful oratory, he told the fellow members something like this. He said, "It's better that one of us should be sacrificed for the good of all than that we should all perish together. We realize the seriousness of this decision, but it is necessary that somebody be sacrificed for the good of the League. The walls of Gibeon are strong and high, and they will delay Joshua and the Israelites long enough for us to complete our own military plans and fortifications. Therefore, we will betray our allies, the Hivites, and toss them to the lions to delay the onrush of this Israelite army until we are ready for the battle." Now, the rest of the League were very sympathetic with the Hivites, and they understood the brilliant strategy of Adonai Zedek, as long as they were not themselves to be the victims. They voted to have it that way. That's the way we did with the Poles. You know, as long as it's not the British and the French and the Russians, let's delay Hitler, let's give him Poland, so that we can make preparations for World War II. Well, the Hivites, however, refused the role of martyr, and they apparently had their own spies at the conference of the League, and when they learned that they were to be offered up as a sacrifice for the rest of the League, they acted first. Promptly. They betrayed the pact before the pact could betray them. They perpetrated one of the shrewdest stratagems of history, and as a result, they gained a secret pact with Israel that made them the servants of God, the God of Israel, in return for protection and security. Now, it is not too much to say that the Hivites were probably the shrewdest people that ever lived on planet Earth, and in defense of that statement, we would offer the ingenious stratagem perpetrated by the Gibeonites. It's the story of which is told in the 9th chapter of Joshua, which chapter we're now discussing. Well, somewhere in their city, these Gibeonites found some old men with frowsy hair and ragged white beards. They dressed them in worn-out garments, and then they put on their feet clouded and broken shoes. They provided these impostors with patched and mended wineskins, in which they put a few pints of sour vinegar. They then gave these men some moldy crusts of bread and sent them forth as ambassadors of their mighty power. Well, into the camp of the children of Israel, these humbugs limped, saying as they came, "We become from a far, far land, a country that is very far removed. And we have heard of the might of Israel and the power of your God, and we have come to make peace. We have come to make a pact with thee." So the princes of Israel replied, "Well, how do we know that you don't belong to this very land that we've come out to conquer?" And these skillful prevaricators humbly replied, "Well, don't you see our worn-out shoes? Can't you see our clothes? These were our newest and best suits when we started on this long, hard journey. And these wineskins that you see, patched and broken, they were new when we left home. They were filled with sweet grape juice, but smell them now." Displaying their moldy crusts of bread, they shook their heads with sorrow and said, "Gentlemen, these were hot biscuits right out of the oven when we started on our trip." So the record states that the princes of Israel were convinced by the victuals. They were convinced by this evidence, and they fell into the trap, and they swore by the honor of God himself that they would never lift sword against the city of these ambassadors. But they made with them a compact of peace and amity forever. Well, we had the audacity to maintain that the Hivites were the shrewdest people that ever lived, and this seems reasonable in the face of the fact that they were the only people in history who have ever been able to beat all of the Jews in a bargain at the same time. Now, if the reader doesn't think that that requires brains, then why don't you just go over here and lie to and deceive a Jew? Now, when the ambassadors were rested, they journeyed, the journey of the horde was then resumed until they came before the walls of Gibeon. So now here are the Israelites in front of Gibeon, along with the ambassadors. And when the princes of Israel prepared the horde for the battle, the ambassadors, these mock ambassadors, said, "Stand thou by and see how we overcome this city." The ambassadors replied, "Not this city. This is our city, protected by your oath of friendship and peace." Well, the princes of Israel raved with indignation, but they were securely trapped and they saw no way out. So characteristically, they made the best of a bad bargain and they got what they could out of the deal. They bound the Gibeonites to themselves by an oath and said, "You shall be the slaves of our God forever." Well, the Gibeonites retorted that it was better to be living slaves of a mighty God than dead rejectors of a compact and a covenant of mutual defense and protection. There being no further use for the army at the moment, Joshua marched the horde up to Gilgal, where they went into rest camp to recover from the ravages of their hard campaigns to date. So when Adonai Zedek, the genius and head of the league, heard of the defection of the Hivites, he was alarmed as well as angered. He reasoned justly that if Israel added to their own army the 30,000 fighting Hivites, the league then was hopeless. Not only was the league weakened, but Israel was strengthened by this number. So he did the only logical thing under the circumstances, and he called upon the rest of the heads to join him, and he informed them of the defection of the Hivites, and he bitterly railed against their lack of faith and fidelity to the pact. It seems to have been all right, in his estimation, for the league to betray a member, but the member must not betray the league. My God, can you imagine how Stalin must have felt? Think of it. Joe Stalin made a pact with Adolf Hitler to divide Poland. And then, after they divided Poland, Adolf Hitler attacked Joe Stalin. Hey, listen, history repeats itself, boys and girls. This isn't the first time that nations have double-crossed nations. It won't be the last. But it makes for an interesting story. We'll have to leave it right there and come back and pick up the story of Adonai Zedek and Joshua's long day next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our webpage. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on our website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, we've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.